Hello and welcome to the Leap of Faith for this Friday, the 5th of January. A new year and a new season ahead for us here on the programme. 2018 looks like being a particularly busy year in the world of faith, and here in Ireland, for many, the visit of Pope Francis in August will be one of those highlights. Well, before we head into the new year, let's take some time this evening to look back, the best tradition, to some of the stories we brought you last year, including a spirited discussion on whether religion causes war. We had Colm O'Gorman from Amnesty International, Barbara Walsh from the Glencree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation, and Dr. Jude Lal Fernando from the Irish School of Ecumenics in Trinity College in the studio.
You know, the way in which religion takes us away from, rather than to, our humanity, to an understanding of our shared and our collective humanity. And I think that's the great tragedy. I mean, faith surely should do that. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as a person of religious faith, but I would certainly see myself as having a faith system. And you know, my belief is grounded in the beauty and goodness of humanity and of life as a wider manifestation of something. I don't think much about it beyond that, because I think what I need to do is live it as best as I possibly can right now. But I think that religion, in how it's practiced, and in more importantly, in how it's imposed, and it's the violence of the imposition of religion, and not just in terms of conflict, but the violence, the degradation of individual, of the goodness of people, of the simple goodness of life, of the potential of us to find good, healthy ways through difficult, human, messy moments or interactions. That's, I think, the great tragedy.
Barbara, is conflict a bad thing? Should it be something to be avoided?
I never think conflict is a bad thing. I think conflict is good. It can be creative and wonderful things can come out of it. It's just when it actually, when it funnels its way into violence, when suddenly somebody wants to hit someone, kill them, or demonise them.
Jude?
Yeah, to add to Barbara, thank you for that question. Not every form of conflict is undesirable. No, every form of peace is desirable. And there are moments we have to disrupt the existing peace. When it comes to religious structures, I would say, you know, the most qualified group of people who can disrupt the established institutional religions, you know, patriarchy and injustices, are the victims. Of course, victims can approach from a human rights perspective, great, and they can also approach from a theological, religious, empathetic perspective, and both have to be recognized.
Let me just go once around the table and ask the same question we put at the beginning to all of you. Does religion cause war and conflict and divide us rather than acting as a unifying force? Barbara.
I think that religion has the potential to act as a unifying force.
Colm?
I can only agree with Barbara on that one. It has that potential, but, you know, as does any human interaction.
And Jude?
That potential is there. And historically, there are moments this potential vacillates. And there are moments that potential has been activated in the countries like India, in South Africa, and in Latin America greatly.
Colm O'Gorman from Amnesty International, Barbara Walsh from the Glencree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation, and Dr. Jude Lal Fernando from the Irish School of Ecumenics and Trinity College, reaching an understanding in what was a very forthright discussion. The business of death caught our attention early in the year, and we spoke with Edwina Fitzgerald, a funeral director in the family business in Rush. I was curious about the skills she required for the job and guessed that sensitivity was one of them.
I'm very, very aware of, I suppose, what families go through. And if I forget that that person that I am making that funeral arrangements for is somebody, somebody, it's always somebody's mother, somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, somebody's wife. And if you forget that that's what you're doing, you shouldn't be doing it.
Is faith still present at an Irish funeral?
80% of funerals, yes, I would say. Now, it mightn't be Catholic faith, it mightn't be Church of Ireland, but there is some faith. There's a lot of spirituality now, more so than, you know, this definite church line where people go and they say, right, the priest has the decision of what's happening. Families want to know what's happening. They want to be involved. They don't want the priest just making all their decisions for them. But yet, no, faith is still there. We still have the tradition of going to the church, going to the cemetery or the crematorium as it is now. But no, we definitely still have a belief in this country.
What about some of the newer faiths that have arrived into the country? What kind of demands do they make on your profession?
They're actually very good when it comes to different religions coming to us as a funeral directors to explain what they want. Lots of them are actually involved in their churches and would have contact with their pastors or their priests, be it whatever religion that they are. And that makes it a lot easier for families. We definitely have a few where I suppose some religions would be quite adverse to me looking after the deceased because I'm a female.
Do you remember that decision to go into the business?
My decision to go into the business was actually, I suppose, one of, it was faith. My mum and dad ran the business for years. My mum died suddenly in 1998. And that was a case of, Dad, I'll help you out for a couple of weeks. And almost 19 years later, I'm still helping out.
What kind of reaction does that bring from people? For example, in your friends and the conversations that they might try and start with you?
Oh, conversations over bottles of wine have been, yeah, there's been a few, but people tend to go, really? That's what you do? You're a funeral director? But you don't look like one. What does one look like? We don't all go around sad and morbid and wearing black day in, day out. We do, you know, have a life outside of what we do is looking after people's loved ones. It's not what we are.
Edwina Fitzgerald there. On that same programme, we heard from Brian Nolan. Brian is Communications and Development Coordinator with the Irish Hospice Foundation. For almost 20 years, he's worked in pastoral care in both the Rotunda and Beaumont hospitals in Dublin. I asked Brian, do we do death well in Ireland?
Well, I think we do when you're dead. I think if you landed in from outer space in Ireland at an Irish funeral, you'd say, wow, this is amazing. If I'm going to die anywhere, I want to die here. But I think, you know, when you're dead, that's it. You know, we'll turn up in thousands to tell the people how brilliant you were. We lay out like a film star and we'll give you a fantastic send-off. And there'll be a big hoolie. But unfortunately, it's the bit before that that I'm actually interested in, the bit where you're actually dying or coming to the end of your life or even from the moment you get that bad news where somebody comes in and says, you know, we can do no more for you. I think then you embark on a journey where you can actually end up being the loneliest person in the world, because we did a national audit on end of life a couple of years ago in the Irish Hospice Foundation. And one of the stark findings that came from that audit, it was the first audit done on end of life care in Ireland ever. And it said, what it found was that when you're dying, everyone is going to be talking about you, but nobody is going to be talking to you. And you know this yourself, you'd often see like staff talking about a family gathered around the bedside of somebody dying, and they'd say, wasn't that very sad about that family? That poor man is dying in there and they're all very upset. And it tends to become all about the family and managing them. And we'll go in and say to the family, how do you think he's doing? But nobody will actually sit with the man or the woman and say, how are you in yourself today?
And that's specifically because we might be afraid of the answer.
Yeah. I think when I ask this question of staff day in, day out, up and down the country, why don't we engage with people when they say things like, I'm not getting better, am I? I think I'm finished. I don't think I'll be going home. I think this is my last Christmas. Our normal response is, oh, sure, I'll be dead before you. Sure, grand. There's nothing wrong with you. Don't be talking like that. You know, come on now. I'm here. I'll keep you well. You're fine. And we close down the conversation and I ask people, well, why would you have that as an automatic response? And people say, well, you don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to make it worse. You don't want to upset the person. You don't want to make them depressed. You don't want them to give up, because if you really got down and talked about this, they might get depressed and die.
Isn't it interesting, too, that there seems to be, certainly in my mind, the idea that there may be two kinds of people and how they approach death, and those that would like to be involved, would like to know, and those who wouldn't like to know at all and might be grateful that it's actually kept from them.
There is, and that's a person's right to not know. And people sometimes will say to you, I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to talk about it. That's their choice. But I think what staff and people working in healthcare around end of life should always be prepared to say, well, that's how you feel today, and that's fine. If at any stage you want to talk to me about this, I'm here. And I will come back again and ask you how you are. Cicely Saunders, she founded the Modern Hospice Movement. And, you know, she said one of the loveliest spiritual questions you could ask somebody is just to sit with the person, look them in the eye and say, how are you in yourself today? And to sit there without having an attachment to the outcome of that conversation.
Brian Nolan from the Irish Hospice Foundation. 2017 was also the year we got the results of the 2016 census. And top of the list for this programme was the data gathered on faith in Ireland. Gina Menzies is a theologian and lecturer in bioethics at the Royal College of Surgeons, and she gave us her interpretation of the figures.
I think people may interpret them according to their own, perhaps, agendas. Seeing a drop of Catholics from 84 to 78%, 6%. I actually personally would have expected it to be much higher, because I think anecdotally, and I suppose particularly living on the Eastern Seaboard, I would know many people who had, you know, given up their faith. So I think, you know, the official church might say 6% in the light of everything that's gone on, and particularly in the Catholic Church with scandals, etc., and even recently with Tuam, though this obviously was done, the census was done before it, they may think that's actually not so bad. But I think behind those figures, there's an awful lot more going on. I think a census is, to an extent, limited because it can only deal with very, you know, basic questions. Do you believe? Do you not believe? You know, have you a faith? Do you not have a faith? And I think many people in Ireland have a have an affiliation to their church and, you know, wouldn't want to say they've totally abandoned it. What kind of religion they're practicing is an entirely different question. And I'm not even sure that the census, you know, can. And I listened to what the man from the statistics office was saying, that it can actually extrapolate that information. I think it's a much more analytical kind of survey that might be needed to establish what really is happening within, particularly within the Catholic and the other Christian churches as well.
Well, it's been interesting to see how different groups have responded to the information. You know, people who were, as you say, a little bit surprised that the figure was higher than they expected immediately put forward the idea, well, if there were that many people who were Catholic, why are the churches empty?
Yes, and I think the reason behind that is because it's too basic or it's too bold a question. I mean, I would say I know many people who still feel that they do live a Christian life, but they don't attend their church regularly. Now, attending their church regularly and how many were baptised used to be the institution's criteria as to whether you were in or out. I think that criteria has hugely changed. I think there was a statement by Cardinal O'Fee a number of years ago, which I still kind of carry with me, and it really said a lot in a very simple sentence. He said, God has many people whom the church doesn't have, and the church has many people whom God doesn't have. And, you know, there's aeons of wisdom behind that statement. I think there are many people in the Irish population who try to live a good life, and they have drawn that from, if you like, their Christian experience, their Christian education, their contact with many organisations that try to live out the gospel. And I think many people in the institution would consider that they're outside the church. And that doesn't bother many people anymore, that the church considers them sort of lost. I think many people, my own view is that many Catholics have decoupled from the institutional church, from Vatican, but they also have an adherence to sort of a spiritual life, an adherence to the gospel according as they can apply it to their lives.
Gina Menzies there from the Royal College of Surgeons, and that data was to be quoted many times by contributors to the Leap of Faith during the year. One of the religions enumerated in that census was that of the Baha'i faith in Ireland, and included Paddy Dawson. Paddy's a familiar voice from radio drama, including Harbour Hotel, Convenience Corner, and the voice of Stephen Dedalus in Ulysses. Well, he dropped in to explain more about the Baha'i faith.
Well, the Baha'i faith was founded by Baha'u'llah. Now, Baha'u'llah lived from 1817, which is why we're having the bicentenary this year of his birth, great celebrations, and he died in 1892.
Now, the background to this faith, it started from a Muslim base, Islam.
In the same way that Christianity began within the Jewish faith, the Baha'i faith did start within the Islamic background. Baha'u'llah himself would have been born into an Islamic family. He was the son of a minister in the court of the Shah of Iran. He was born in Tehran. And it was expected that Baha'u'llah would follow his father into this distinguished position. However, Baha'u'llah himself proved as a young person to be very interested in the poor, the sick. He loved nature. He was very philanthropic in his attitude to things. Now, in his early 20s, he became involved with a number of people in Iran who were expecting the coming of the promised one, not only of Islam, but of all the great faiths in the world, because all the great faiths, as they teach in the Baha'i faith, they have a lot in common with each other. In fact, we don't see them as being opposed to each other in any way. And one of the things they have in common was the looking forward in the future, in a kind of prophetic way, to the time when a special person would come who would bring peace and harmony on the earth. Like for a Christian, that would be God's kingdom coming on earth as it is in heaven, as we say in the Our Father or the Lord's Prayer. So Baha'u'llah then became part of these people, and they began to be heavily persecuted by the authorities.
Yeah, let's put that in context, because yes, for him, as a Muslim, it is in contravention of that belief to deny the Prophet Muhammad.
Well, I am not a theologian of Islam or any other faith, in fact, you know, but actually this was used against, it's still used against Baha'is sometimes internationally. But in fact, when people look at Islam, those who know about it, those I've spoken to, say that this is not the case, that according to Islam, somebody would come in the future. Baha'u'llah later, as this great, his life is such a great drama. It's one of the greatest dramas in history. And anybody interested, just go online to one of the Baha'i websites and you'll find it so fascinating.
Paddy Dawson of the Baha'i Faith in Ireland. Well, later in the year, I took a trip to London and met with a woman who grew up in Calcutta. Although Muslim, she was educated there by Irish Loretto nuns and has gone on to become one of the most influential and powerful women in Britain. Pinky Lilani is not only a highly successful entrepreneur, she's the founder of the Asian Women of Achievement Awards and 10 years ago received an OBE. And what's really fascinating is the strong connection she makes between cooking and spirituality.
Part of my faith in Islam when we were growing up, it was about feeding others. You know, in the Quran we constantly talk about feeding those who are orphaned or who don't have enough food. So it was very much a core of our beliefs. And so bringing people together to eat was always something that was very important. And I still, the greatest joy I get is when I invite people home or, you know, for work and actually give them food. For me, it's part of that nurturing element, which is all about me. I love being able to embrace others, to see how, to make them feel loved, to be warm, compassionate, to really hear their stories. So authenticity has to be at the core of our lives.
I heard a rumor that you bring a wok with you when you travel.
I love taking my wok with me. So when I go to some very big companies and I'm talking about leadership and, you know, inspiring people, I actually take my wok, plug it in at the end of a talk and make spicy Bombay potatoes. And I think it's that, oh my God, what is she doing with this wok? And the wok has had an amazing life. It's been to places like the Judge Business School at Cambridge. It's been inside, you know, some of the big corporates. It's been inside Radio 4. And I remember, you know, when I take the wok, they want to do a risk assessment. So in one place, I had a fire marshal sitting with a fire extinguisher next to me in case I set fire to the place. But the only thing I did do, which got everybody very excited, was the smell of garlic and coriander went everywhere, so I became a real magnet. So I love taking the wok because that's creativity.
People often say that we live in a more secular time and people don't hold to faith in exactly the same way. What would your hope be that people wouldn't lose if they became less attached to their faith? What would you ask them to hold on to?
I think I would ask them to hold on to the core values that our faith teaches us. So for me, religion is all about, you know, compassion, about kindness, about being a good person, about thinking of what's going to happen after we're here. You know, it's not all about just now. And I think there is something. I know when you do good deeds, you feel good. When you're unkind, you don't feel good. I don't think any faith teaches you anything different. I think the manifestations may be different. In Islam, we believe that, you know, our souls will go up to heaven. There's a judgment day. I think in Hinduism, it's a different belief. But I think what they teach us about now is the most important thing. And I think, I hope we never lose that. And I have faith, actually, that, you know, people will still keep those values that are important.
Pinky Lilani, who shared the connection between spirituality, faith and food with me last year. Well, another passionate person of faith we met in 2017 was Dr. Anthony Campolo. Anthony was once the spiritual advisor to President Bill Clinton. You have an interesting perspective on how Jesus would be perceived here and now, and maybe even as he was at one stage in Jerusalem. In business, you hear people talking a lot about disruptors, people who get in there and change things. You'd hold that Jesus himself was a disruptor.
Yes, I would have to say they did not put him on the cross. They did not crucify him because he said, be nice to each other. He was on the cross because the things that he said were disruptive of the political and economic systems of the day. They saw him as a threat to the established social order. He said radical things. If you go to the Sermon on the Mount, you will see the radical nature of it. For instance, here in the United States, we still have a serious problem with capital punishment, and mostly among people who call themselves evangelicals, even though Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." When he talked about money, he really raises some very serious questions about the way in which our hyper-Calvinistic and shall I say, capitalistic system operates. The idea that the purpose of production is to maximize profits. You say, what's wrong with that? Not much, except this, that you can make a lot of profit without meeting people's needs. The purpose of production, we would say, and Jesus said, was to meet people's needs. Whatsoever you do, whether in word or in deed, you should do as unto the Lord. That's his philosophy, to take care of the poor. Nobody talked about the poor more than Jesus did. So we're really saying in strong language, we want a societal system that takes care of the poor people in our society. You say, what about the rich people? And my response is, and I think Red Letter Christian's response is, the rich have a capacity to take care of themselves. We really have to watch out for poor people in our society.
But that's uncomfortable. That actually requires action on the behalf of a Christian who's going to take, that different view.
Well, you know, if you're going to take Jesus seriously, and that's what the Red Letter Christians movement is all about, we basically ask, did Jesus really mean what he said? Here's what he said. If you want to be my disciple, sell what you have, give the money to the poor, take up the cross and follow me. If any man would be my disciple, let that person deny himself and forsake all for the sake of others. So it is radical stuff. There is no question about it. And that's why they crucified him. They crucified him because he was a radical disruptor of the political economic order of his day.
Dr. Anthony Campolo, who joined us from his home in Philadelphia on the Leap of Faith. Well, back in May of last year, gospel music was very much in the air. The Gospel Rising Music Festival in its eighth year took place in Galway. And Lindsay Rountree, one of the organisers, shared his enthusiasm for the event.
I think if you went through any parish in any little village or town anywhere, you'll come across a gospel choir. We know of about 90 gospel choirs that are active around the country. Some you'll know kind of very well and big household names, and some are just people who are involved in their own community and doing small little bits. But it's because of that style of music is so enjoyable and so energetic. It also brings a lot to people as well. It's not just about singing. It's not just about the health benefits, which have been kind of publicized about singing between your mental health and your physical health, but also it's that part of a group. It's singing and speaking about music and words with a message. It's that involvement as well. And, and a lot of people would be involved in church that would be involved in this kind of style of music, but a lot of people who aren't. And some choirs are either. You know, it doesn't make any odds, doesn't make any difference. It's all about people coming together.
Lindsay Rountree of the Gospel Rising Music Festival. Well, a few weeks ago, we were out on the streets in Dublin one evening, retracing the steps of Dean Jonathan Swift as part of the 350th anniversary of his birth. Also here with us this evening is the current Dean of St. Patrick's, and that's the very Reverend Dr. William Morton. Dean, you are in a direct line back from Swift. How does it actually sit with you as you're here? Do you feel his presence sometimes?
I actually do feel his presence quite often, both here in the cathedral and also too in the deanery, because I know there was a fire in the house in 1781, and I know he had died in 1745, but we believe that quite a bit of the building remained the house in which he had actually lived. So I do, when I look at the books that he wrote and had published, and I think of the rooms and coming in the entrance hall and everything, I do often think that his spirit is surrounding us.
So a lot has been done and a lot of people have looked at his work as a satirist, but you're looking at him as a clergyman. Is there an extra insight into that role that he had here?
I think see in him a person who put into practice his belief in God and the Christian faith. We see a person of immense kindness. We see it in his outreach to people in society who suffered from social injustices. So I think if he were here today, he would be reaching out to people who are really on the margin in society in terms of homeless, people who are underprivileged, people who are, of course, trying to grapple with mental illness. And of course, his legacy was to the building of St. Patrick's Hospital here. So, and through the office of Dean, I am a member of the board of St. Patrick's Hospital. So there's a wonderful sort of continuity and continuation of all the aims and objectives of SWIFT through us here in the cathedral and in Dublin in our generation.
So there you have it, some of the voices from 2017 heard on The Leap of Faith, sharing diverse perspectives into people and faith. And we look forward to hearing many more of them in the weeks to come and invite you to join us on Friday evenings just after 10. From all of us on the programme, Happy New Year.